tell me the truth. The bird in your mouth for what you say. And pieces of paper in the way. Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. We cover the arts, current affairs, popular culture, and everything else in between. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
Can't continue pretending to choose. It's opposite sides on which we fall. Loving you later, if at all. No right minds could wrong be this many times.
This month, my show's in two parts. In the first, I tell a story, a tale of a little town that could, Catskill, and its continuing attempts to survive, to stay relevant, attract new business and new people. Later, I interview local author Emily Upham, co-editor of In the Fullness of Time, a series of essays by 32 women over 50. But first, the story and what happens when Wall Street meets Main Street, Catskill.
This was not my idea. It was the idea of Gino Rodriguez, former director of the Alternative Museum. I met him in an opening at Sarah Barker's studio. And he says to me at the opening, I can't wait to help you put Catskill on the cultural map. And I thought he was joking, but it still sort of struck me right in the heart, because that is what I've been working on, is making this a cultural destination. And I almost wept right there. You know, to tell you the truth, I felt like crying when I got back. That it feels like something's happening right now. That a lot of people and ideas are coalescing to make this a really important place for artists and all kinds of artists.
That was Fawn Potash, director of Masters on Main Street, talking about the genesis of Wall Street to Main Street, the latest offshoot of the Masters on Main Street.
But, you know, one of the objectives of Masters on Main Street is for artists to play a role in civic life here. And this project, Wall Street to Main Street, is a great example of that, of artists taking a leading role in civic change. So I'm proud of this as an artist and as a curator, but especially as an artist. So weeks pass, Gino, Wall Street, I think it was maybe October when this happened. So, you know, Wall Street, the Wall Street occupation started September 17th. So things were hot. And there's a lot of stuff going on the internet. And Gino sees this article and he sends it to me, forwards it to me. And I just sat on it for 2 weeks. I thought I was going to be doing a project with Bard's Curatorial Studies Department. And they're very busy. Their curriculum is so packed, they really don't have time to fit in a special project like this. So they backed out at the last minute, and I had nothing. But I had a scheduled slot with nothing planned. So I said, Gino, let's do this. And I mentioned it to my boss, Kay Stamer, the director of the Arts Council, and she said, well, no, no. I mean, it's too. It's too much to ask of the community, a conservative community, to welcome protesters. And I thought about it for a day, and I decided this is really worth fighting for. Really, this is the important dialogue of our time. And one of the things that helped give me courage was actually the cover of Time magazine. You know, the person of the year for Time magazine was the protester. And I thought, oh my God, if Time magazine can say that, we can too. We are bigger than our fears. So I pressed Kay a little bit, and she said, okay, if you can sell the board and some key community members and enough building owners to make that happen, let's do it. And we did. Yeah, I got a unanimous vote from the board. I felt like, okay, well, and that sort of put wind in my sails for in terms of talking to building owners and people in the leadership in the village. And to tell you the truth, the village board is very ambivalent. There's some on the board who are really looking forward to this project, and others who are feeling like they're not big fans of the Occupy movement, but they are big fans of anything that brings attention and new interest to our main street, and they're willing to try it. So I've gotten incredible cooperation from the village, building owners, artist ambassadors, all over the Hudson Valley. It takes more than a village to pull this off. I've gotten help from 4 of the Hudson Valley's best digital printers to pull off a show. It's really amazing. Everybody's helping me.
Enter Paul McLean, the co-organizer of Occupy with Art, an offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
One of our things that we had dedicated to doing was reaching into the activist infrastructure, but also the not-for-profits who are dedicated to 99% concerns, and making alliances that made sense. And when I found out about the Green County Arts Council and Masters on Main Street through Gino, and started to do some research about Catskill, this seemed like a good fit for the project that we had in mind, and so we moved forward with Gino's big idea. We had over 70 or 80, roughly 70 or 80 submissions to our international call for entries for Wall Street to Main Street. And it was very fast turnover, very fast timeline to get the proposals or accept the artists and then, you know, vet the proposals and then try to begin the installation process in time for the opening, which is going to happen this weekend. So really the undertaking is incredibly ambitious, and there's a real spectrum of people that are involved. Everyone from the Buckminster Fuller People Institute and Buckminster Fuller Institute and Mark Skwarek, an incredible augmented reality maker. And then on the other side, you have people that have really never had experience in formal art environments. There's really a lot to work through in terms of trying to place those works in the space. And the nature of this enterprise is really interesting also because the movement is in a transitional phase. There's still a massive amount of interest, I guess I would call it, in what's actually happening with Occupy.
In terms of exhibits, there are about 20 sites on Main Street with either a window display or an interior exhibition. And then in the 10 weeks that the show is on display, every week there are 2 or 3 events planned. And those events might be musical performances. There's a one-man play. There's seminars, panel discussions, and hands-on workshops. And the idea is that the more events you have, the more people will come back to Main Street. And all the events are meant to be engaging in a way that people can participate and become part of and learn more about the issues at the heart of the Occupy movement. I just got a piece from a high school student at Catskill High School. But there are local artists from Greene County, artists from across the river in Columbia County, and then moving out toward the edges, Hudson Valley artists, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, D.C., and there's a contingent of international documentary photographers, including a Pulitzer Prize-winning Lucienne Perkins. You know, and they're photographing Occupy movements in Indonesia, Spain, all over the world. So it's a collaboration with everyone.
The artists, some are given individual spaces, but that's determined in some cases, but simply by logistics. It could be a storefront window, so it's not really a show in the sense of it. So you're really dealing with an uneven surface, and so the show that Gino's installing at Brick is really kind of like a formal gallery show in a way, and it has those kind of features, and it'll look like that once it's installed. But many of the other works that we're installing in spaces don't have that kind of architecture for the work that's going in. So it's each one of them is very different. But really, it's one show. I mean, it's not really even a show. I would call it an exposition, in the old sense. It's really a different kind of program. I would maybe call it a program or a project. You know, what Fawn does with the Masters on Main Street is a really good use of the available space. But let's face it, I mean, one of the reasons we're here is because in Occupy Wall Street, we're facing the conditions that the kind of empty storefronts on Main Street Catskill represent an epidemic that's really symptomatic of a devastated economy that's across this nation, affecting this nation north, south, east, and west. And the Catskills Main Street is really beautiful. If you have a certain eye for that, I've traveled back and forth across this country many times, and the blue highways often pass through the main streets of the small towns, and what's happened as a result of economic and political policy over the last 30 years is that those communities and those main streets have been devastated. And so we're not just here to have shows. This is not just about having an art show. This is really about something else. In addition to that, we're trying to treat each artist's work with respect and each artist with respect. But we're the term come lately is precarious. The precarity even, and it's talked about as in some discourses as a kind of cultural environment, but it's a reality for people, and we're coming into this community to deal with it directly, not as an artistic proposition, but as an exchange, a point of exchange, where we can find a connection between Wall Street and Catskill that truly is 99%.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. And I've been talking to Fawn Potash, director of the Masters on Main Street, and Paul McLean, co-organizer of Occupy with Art. And they've both been describing the new Wall Street to Main Street exhibit, which opens this Saturday in Catskill.
One of the great features of Occupy Wall Street is that it's a conversation starter, and has never in. And I'm not a representative of Occupy Wall Street as such, and I'm only speaking for myself here. But one of the things that occurs to me is that, and I've heard this said by one of my co-organizers in Occupy with Art, that named Chris Cobb, he writes for San Francisco MoMA, a blog, and his suggestion is that Occupy Wall Street has started some great conversations, and if nothing else, it's been about starting some conversations that need to be started. So I think if there's something that's good that can come out of this, it will be. But one thing I can say is that some of the models, this is being proposed in a sense as a template or a model for how to replicate what we're doing here. It's many of the processes, as much as we can, that are involved in the production of Wall Street to Main Street are being shared as open source information online in a variety of forms. And so one of our goals is to explore what is that model for when a community in some way has been neglected by the government and by the economy or the movers that in the economy, left behind in the extraction exploitation complex, then what do we do in the meantime while we're fighting for change in those areas? And this is one thing that can be done.
Here's Fawn again.
Saturday, we'll be unveiling windows, 2 to 5. Party is at Brick, 473 Main Street, from 5 to 8. And there's a surprise at dusk on the street. There's going to be a custom augmented reality tour by Mark Skowarek. And, I'd never heard of augmented reality before this, planning for this event. And he's a really unique artist who's bringing video game technology to art. And it's this tour. If you watch it in person, you'll see him in his car traveling down Main Street. If you look at it on your smartphone or your tablet, you'll see a king in a boat on a flooded street. And their narration will be about it'll be about Catskill's history, its economic ups and downs, its cultural history, and he's interviewed a lot of people in the process of putting the narration together. So those people who don't have smartphones or tablets, we're going to make an effort to project it on a wall so everyone can see it. One of the objectives of the Masters on Main Street project is to bring audiences to town, to bring people from outside of our area in, and create more creative community, and get some people renting on Main Street, and get some people to invest in Main Street, maybe open another restaurant. Ultimately, my personal objective is to have a wine bar with a good list. That new Mexican restaurant, Casa Latina, opened today, and that made my day. They were packed. The empanadas were fantastic. I ate off everyone else's plate at lunch, and the tamales were good. Everything was great. So we're on our way. So Masters on Main Street and this project, my objectives are to bring great art to Catskill, and in this case, bring art that raises the dialogue about important issues. And also, we have this twin goal of a Main Street development program. And I want more great neighbors. I want to bring my tribe here. And there's a lot of interest from the artists involved in the Occupy movement in this area. Partly because it's cheap. It's cheap to rent and it's cheap to buy.
We've been approached by cities and towns for months who really would like us to come and do things like this. And I can understand why. There's not a works project, administrate arts in action program right now that would be an immediate boost, provide maybe jobs with dignity for creative people. There's never been more highly trained artists and creative workers in the United States. The statistics for jobs for young people coming out of college who have a great deal of training behind them already, who are doing without work or underemployed, who could immediately have an impact on communities like this one, who are not being given jobs like that through the government, through the similar type of program. And the companies who are siphoning through derivative markets and other ways, huge treasures, and depriving economies like Catskills of any kind of hope of self-sustaining, and causing incredible devastation in communities. Those people are absolutely not coming to the table with anything. And so I think if one understands that a public art program like the WPA, the history of which has been greatly suppressed in this country by the same people who would love to have everyone with $1 billion of disposable income shopping at the Armory Show over the past week, that the idea that this nation could devote its resources to the support of arts and culture as opposed to fighting wars voluntarily, I think is a question that should be asked here. What we're doing is with no budget, really, except for the generosity of Green, you know, the supporters of Green County Arts Council, and those sums are tiny, and so we're doing what we can with what we have. People are trying to figure out how to get here from New York to help here, and often these people are people with not a lot of means, and who have to work in ways that. Deprive them of a lot of luxury to survive. And so there's a lot of sacrifice being made. People like Fawn are sacrificing in order to make this happen. And it's really a gift exchange in a way. People caring for each other in ways that the government or the economic communities are failing to do, even though that is their mandate. You know, and it's we the people. This is a democracy, at least in name today, and the infrastructure of it, at least to a degree enough, is still in existence. That it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace that this is. These are the kind of conditions that a good community. Thomas Cole's his museum is here, where American art supposedly began, and unfortunately, many of the paintings that he executed are in places like the new Walmart Museum. Those are in a sense local treasures in a way. I mean, certainly in Europe. And around the world, the practices for assigning cultural significance to things and keeping them where they have that matters. And even in terms of global issues, that Catskill has a history, and Catskill is a significant part of American history. And it's a significant part of American art history. Frederick Church, this neighborhood, a lot of people that are here as artists that retired from New York or that live in these communities in the Hudson River Valley are some of the most important art and literature and culture in the United States has come from this as a kind of heartland, not just because it's relative to New York. And I think if you drove down Catskill's Main Street, you might not know that. And I think that's a shame. Mm. You know, so that to me, if anyone takes away anything, is from this show, it should be the Catskill matters.
And as for the future?
Our next round five is a collaboration with the New York Foundation for the Arts. And they are a statewide organization that serves artists and organizations, but primarily artists. And they have, every year they do a competition, and the fellowship winners get $7,000 each to do whatever they want with it. And so the fellowship winners, the best of New York State, will be showing in Catskill. And they'll be doing workshops, seminars, mostly professional development workshops. Mm-hmm. Every weekend of this 10 weeks, I want people to check our website regularly so that they know what's going on, or at least sign up to get an e-blast from us. So you can reach me, fawn@greenarts.org. And green is GREENEARTS. Or check our website, www.greenarts.org.
My guests were Fawn Potash and Paul McLean, both of whom I'd like to thank very much for being on Between the Lines. Next up, my interview with local author Emily Upham, so don't go anywhere.
Memory is cruel, queen of attentions and details, defending intentions if he fails. Until now, he told me her name, it sounded familiar in a way that I could have sworn I'd heard him say it 10,000 times. Oh, if only
Upham is a classical pianist trained in Paris and New York, who also accompanies and coaches singers. She's been a French interpreter for the US State Department, is a life coach, and is the co-author, along with Linda Gravenson, of In the Fullness of Time, 32 Women on Life After 50, featuring the essays by artists, writers and actors, activist icons and pioneers such as Dr. Christine Northrup, Sharon Olds, Tina Howe, Erica Young, actress Jane Alexander, writer Edna O'Brien, and actress Claire Bloom. One reviewer said of the book it was as if they were all guests, quote, gathered at a richly surreal and logistically improbable party, some of the brightest minds and fullest hearts of the English-speaking female world, exquisitely chosen and sympathetically welcomed. Welcome to Between the Lines, Emily.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I should also add that, of course, you live and work in Germantown.
That's correct.
And I'm hoping that you will read an excerpt.
Well, I will read several paragraphs of the preface, which really explain how this project came to have a life. Once upon a time, when I was a young and beautiful princess of 20 and living in the land of Paris, France, I fell in love with a man of 59 whom I shall call S. He was renowned throughout the entire kingdom of the moving image. Even then there were telephones, and he would call me in my turret and say, "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your long hair and sweep me away." Our story grabbed me by the jugular, gave me no choice, and shaped my entire life. For 40 years, we have been crucial to each other. For 40 years, we have told each other everything. As I write this, S will soon be 97. I do not know how I will live without him. Recently, on the heels of my fifth spinal surgery, my performance career as a classical pianist was laid to rest. The journey away from my chosen but unforgiving instrument, its white teeth bared permanently in a glaring challenge, has been marked by a broken vertebra, degenerating discs, semi-successful surgeries, denial, and finally a snarling quasi-acceptance. It came to me suddenly that my generation, the baby boomers, had arrived at the second half of life, and that this half would be laden with loss. The generation of women forged by the 1960s, the youth generation, is now facing the death of parents, friends, and spouses, the loss of health, of sexual power, of power in the workplace, of dreams, of time remaining. Ours is the mapless generation. We came of age at a fleeting moment in history when all traditional expectations were tossed aside and torn up like confetti. Our womanhood was forged at a time when birth control was easy, abortion was easy, pursuing a career was easy, when there were no rules, no boundaries, no directions other than our own inner ones, if we were lucky enough to have them. Many of us never married, many of us never had children. Many of our lives were skewed by this upheaval, even as it paved the way for the many positive changes for women who came after us. As we age and begin to suffer the losses common to us all, our landscape is a very different one from that of the women who came both before and after us. My startled awakening to these truths was the impetus for this project. I turned for guidance to Linda Gravenson, a gifted editor and writer a few steps ahead of me who had suffered and come through a number of losses. She became my collaborator, and together we explored how these storms of change could bring unexpected rewards. My urgent quests for maps to chart the terrain of later life led us to gather a number of unusual women, world-renowned authors and artists. Ranging in age from 55 to 101, they are immersed in or have emerged from maelstroms of change. From Edna O'Brien on one continent to Gail Godwin on another, they have all responded to the universality of our theme and have participated generously in this project. Their essays have been written for this book.
Thank you, Emily. That was wonderful. And of course, you've now just answered all my questions. That's the end of the interview. What struck me about this collection is that it's really just a collection of great writing, actually, rather than being, I mean, I know it's about a specific theme, but you know, people should read it just for the quality of the writing, because there's some very hard, heartfelt yes. writing in there. There's some very heartfelt comments, and
I decided to collect mainly writers for this collection because I knew they would express themselves eloquently and very specially. So the writing is really quite marvelous.
Not being a writer yourself, that was quite an undertaking to switch from being a classical pianist to undertaking something like this. When you were approaching great writers and saying, you know, would you write this for me? I mean, what was it that really made you think that you wanted to do that, and that frankly that people would even
pay any attention to you
whatsoever?
Well, I think because I was not a so-called writer, I had no inhibitions about writing. I couldn't have done it about playing the piano, for instance. And we wrote, Linda and I, a very, very honest letter to these women about what I was going through and the help that I was seeking. And we asked them if they would like to participate. And the response was enormous. I think because of the honesty and the rawness of the letter, it wasn't just a polite letter about writing a book. It really let it rip about loss and things that were coming down the track.
Okay, so you have to now tell us what was something that was in the letter that would make Erica Young, Edna O'Brien.
Quite honestly, the 97-year-old man who has since died was a very, very famous filmmaker who was very respected by all of these people. And the mention of his name in the letter, I think, was very important in bringing a number of people aboard.
I'm going to ask you the question. Okay, I will. Okay. So you can't tell us who it was.
I can tell you. It was Jules Dassin, or Jules Dassin, who was like a father to me. He almost raised me from my teens, and he was a mentor to me, and our relationship lasted, as I said, for about 40 years, and he was very, very important in my life, and I dreaded the loss of him.
And how long ago did he die?
He died, what are we now, 2012, 4 years ago, I think. Yes.
Why did you choose these women?
Well, Linda and I chose to write letters to all of the many, many of the women we admired as writers and as human beings. And there are also four interviews in the book with non-writers, those being Claire Bloom, Jane Alexander, Marta Casals Istemann, who was married both to Pablo Casals, and Eugene Istemann, the great musicians. And the fourth interview I am blanking on right now. I can't remember.
And those interviews are, in fact, Q&As.
Yes, they are. For instance, I had to ring Claire Bloom at her home in London and just off the cuff start talking to her about these very, very personal things. I was very nervous, but she was wonderful. She was honest and vulnerable and involved, and spoke very, very much to the point. Every one of these women did. They were all open and vulnerable in their answers. It was wonderful.
Do you think that was just because nobody had ever asked them these kind of questions before?
I don't know, but these are the women who answered yes to our letters of inquiry. So the writers who were not interested in participating were not there. These women clearly had something that they wanted to say on the subject, and they said it.
And so nothing quite like it had been done before then?
I don't think so. I think that there were a lot of books written about how these later years are supposed to be the most marvelous years of our life. But from where I was sitting at the time, it sure didn't look to me to be the case. And I went to women who were slightly older than I and who had already gone through some of these losses in an attempt to find some kernel of truth, of knowledge, of help, of insight that was going to help me in everything that seemed to be coming like a tsunami at me. And at all of my colleagues, when I started speaking to other women my age, I was interested to see that they were all experiencing a lot of these feelings.
Some of these essays are very moving. I mean, people are very honest.
Very honest.
And there's some very poignant language here. And I have to also say that some of them are quite hard to read.
Yes.
Because they bring up questions that some of us who are over 50 yes. may not actually want to address.
Well, you can skip those ones.
Just go to the fun-filled ones.
There are some very funny ones too. We tried to find a balance between dark and light and hope that we did it. But there's no question that some very heavy subjects are taken on here.
One of the women who did not agree to participate, but who wrote you a letter anyway, of course, was Doris Lessing, right?
Doris Lessing did.
Would you like to read what she says in her letter? Because I found it so fascinating.
Yes, Doris Lessing chewed me out a little bit. She said, "Dear Emily Upham, you wrote to me and I wrote back. Here is the evidence. But not long ago, I found a little cachet of several unposted letters, and yours was one. They slid under a book, with lots of typos, I might add." She typed this letter. Okay. "The trouble is, I've written more than one piece about growing old, and the thought of doing another makes me yawn. One has to wonder, do these younger women have no grandmothers? Women live so much older, longer now. It is impossible to read her typing, but she says it is hard to imagine that there are no role models to ask. Good wishes, Doris Lessing.
Right, well, okay. Thus spake Doris Lessing. What did that make you feel, getting that kind of letter?
I was thrilled that she had taken the time to write back to me. I was just touched by it. I got two letters from her, in fact, and I was just amazed. I got letters from people all over the world, famous writers who had far better things to do than answer my letters, even when they said no. I got a wonderful refusal letter from Nadine Gordimer, for instance. It obviously touches a very sensitive chord in people, this subject, needless to say. And people really did respond to the call.
And did everyone write something original, or did they...
All original. They were all written for this book. Yes.
Yeah. Now, the title, In the Fullness of Time, 32 Women on Life After 50, does that rather mean that it's only women over 50 are going to read this book? Does that kind of narrow your potential audience?
We weren't happy with the title. It was not the title that we chose. These things are dictated by, in this case, Simon & Schuster. I think there's a lot of wisdom to be had in this book for women who are under 50 as well. I think that women in their 20s and 30s aren't thinking about these subjects yet, but from 40 to 101, they are. So it covers a broad spectrum.
Yes, it's kind of unavoidable. Do you think men could do a book like this? Would they even want to?
We thought of doing a book about men, for men, and it's something that we might do someday. I think they go through a similar crisis for different reasons, perhaps. However, women, just in terms of marketing, which is very highly considered today, the publishing world is in such crisis, women tend to read a lot more than men do. And women tend to read this kind of material more than men do. So we started out with women because I am one and I was in trouble.
If you have just joined us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here with Emily Upham, who is the co-author and editor of In the Fullness of Time, 32 Women on Life After 50. Can I ask how you were in trouble?
I was in great fear and trepidation. I felt these losses coming, the loss of my profession, number one, which was kind of like a loss of identity, the loss of Jules Dassin, who was going to be represent an enormous loss for me because he had been in my life for so many years, and many other people were dying around me or beginning to die around me, and I just couldn't imagine how people did this phase of life. I was absolutely like a deer in headlights, as if a meteorite was about to land from space on my head, and I needed to know how to do this.
And one thing that we should mention is, of course, that you had to give up your career as a classical pianist.
Yes, I had to give up performing because it's become impossible for my back to practice that many hours. I've since had even a couple more surgeries. Mm. So this the writing of this book, this project, this that took several years, was really a wonderful transition for me, because instead of just mourning losses, I made a project out of loss and turned it into
a volume published by Simon & Schuster.
A volume published by Simon & Schuster that many, many women have appreciated. I'm happy to say it is in its second printing, and it's had a very, very fine reception.
Now, this actually came out almost 2 years ago.
That's right.
And what was the immediate reaction? What kind of feedback did you get?
all wonderful. We got many, many wonderful reviews. We were invited to speak in many important places. We were at the 92nd Street Y in New York. We were in Woodstock with Gail Godwin, who lives in Woodstock. We were all over. We were in Linda, who spends a lot of her time in California, gave a number of readings with the West Coast authors. And so there was a large number of people exposed to the book very quickly. And the question and answer periods were so lively and so to the heart. It was hard to end the evenings.
The other thing that occurred to me when I was reading some of the essays is that all these women are accomplished, they're famous, they're rich, mm-hmm. in the main part. What kind of a book did you think about doing a book about with unknown women, women who don't have their resources?
My first desire was to do a book of unknown women. And frankly, since I was an unknown writer, I understood that if anybody was going to pay attention to me, I had better
get some names,
bring in some important names. And it's purely for that reason. But it's also interesting to see that no matter how famous you are, no matter how celebrated, you suffer these same trials and tribulations. They were very honest, the women, very honest. I was very moved. And many of them have become good friends, and that's been a wonderful prize to come out of the project as well.
Is there anything that you can say that you learned from all of this? Is there a lesson in this?
There are little bits of nuggets of wonderful wisdom and thought in many of the essays that I always recall and use to help myself if I'm getting blue or something. The fortitude and the real courage of so many of these women in the face of shattering life circumstances is very inspiring. I think, I don't know if you had a chance to read Entosaki Shange's essay. She had a stroke at the age of 50 and was facing terrific odds with enormous courage. I was helped by the sisterhood, in a sense. I felt very bound to all of these women. I was interested to see that it wasn't just my dilemma, that it seemed to be everybody's dilemma, and that we were all in it together, and that's how we were going to get through it, together.
So it might be said to be lessons in courage as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think many of the essays are very inspiring.
A sequel? Are you working on something else, perhaps?
I am working on a memoir myself, but that won't be ready for a while. And as to whether we do a book for men, remains to be seen.
Remains to be seen. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about? First of all, where can people get hold of this book?
This book is sold on Amazon. It's sold in most bookstores. It's really very easy to find. It was an enormous transformation period for me to come away from playing the piano to doing something else. And writing has become very important to me, as has my life coaching. I had done psychoanalytic studies much earlier on in life, and I wanted to continue more or less in that vein. And I've ended up working with mostly people in the arts who need help, and at rather low fees, because I feel that people should have access to help that they can afford, which is rarely the case in this country. And I've been surprised to find how rewarding the coaching work has been. So come one, come all.
Yes, well, I'm sure you certainly have a lot to tell people and advise people upon. And as we started with a reading, I thought perhaps that we could end with a reading. Edna O'Brien has contributed a short essay. It's called Last Word. I'm going to read it. The waiting, the wanting, the grieving, the hating, the hoping,
rudderless. The heart closed, not only to the self, but to others, fearing to reach out because the wounded being is the least likable. There is prayer, but not everyone prays. There is drink, but, as Keats wisely said, wine is only sweet to happy men. And there is literature. I see this not as a writer, but as a reader. For me, the link between literature and spirituality is irrefutable. It is not a fashionable theory, but I know it to be true. In loss, loneliness, thwartdom, in many adversities, great writing can be a consolation. Not long ago, I was in a hospital in Ireland, first in intensive care, and then in a public ward that seemed like bedlam, what with teams of visitors and giant television blaring and children wretched at being parted from their parents and their sick mothers and consultants and doctors and nurses and students and cleaners and, more than once, watching some unfortunate woman being given the last rites. I was kept sane by one book, Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us, which I had in my handbag on that blithe day before illness struck. Reading her wise and prophetic words about the universe and how we are destroying it was not only salutary, but made my circumstances more bearable. Had I had King Lear, I would have read that. Perhaps the scene where the broken king wants to believe that Cordelia is alive. Or I might have read the piquant scene in Henry IV among Falstaff, Mistress Quickly, and Mistress Doll Tearsheet in the Boar's Head Tavern in London, or jaunty Mrs. Dalloway buying flowers in Bond Street, or Sylvia Plath's profound poem, Poppies in July. So when we hit rock bottom, we can read the words that exactly mirror our emotional state. Therefore, I say, God, stand up for literature. There is the thrill of reading, and there is the wisdom within it. Great writing allows us to share the physical and psychic intensity of the author, thereby vitiating our own words. Goethe said, all my works were fragments of a great confession. In times of tribulation, we need to be reminded of the great confession. A motto not just for an hour or a day, but for all the nights and all the days as we slouch towards eternity. Thank you, Edna. That was lovely. And I want to thank my guest here, Emily Upham, who has written a wonderful collection of essays called In the Fullness of Time. Thank you so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that's my show for this month. I'll be back at the same time, Thursday at 2 p.m., the third Thursday of every month, next month, which is April. I hope you will listen.
I thought I was ready to bleed. Then we moved from the shadow.